This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that change exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. Join me and an all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time and revisit the unthinkable crimes of some of the most notorious murderesses of the 19th and 20th centuries from the UK, the USA and Australia.
We beat him dreadfully upon the floor. We washed our hands in his crimson gore.
She told me, "I wish to get rid of the child before I get home. I hate the very sight of her, and there will be no peace all the time that she is alive."
The female prisoner Manning premeditated, planned and concocted the murder, and she made her husband her dupe and instrument for that purpose.
I saw her use a small switch on the child, and I saw her kicking the child, and she hit her as far as the swing.
I took the body of the baby out of the hole in the garden. Its death may have arisen from two causes, either from suffocation or from violent injuries.
Today, we're taking a peek behind the scenes of Lady Killers, lifting the curtain on how we go about investigating the cases of our infamous murderesses. In some of our cases, our female perpetrators have left behind only a few tantalising scraps of evidence, so we have to carefully build up a picture of what really happened. In others, though, we're overwhelmed by stacks of documents. For Maria Manning, whose case was called the Bermondsey Horror, we have lurid headlines, meticulous police records, and wildly conflicting testimonies for Maria and her husband. Today, we'd like to talk about how we use evidence to seek the truth and to try to hear what our lady killers are really trying to tell us about their lives. In a world where power was largely held in male hands, how can we use these records to recover women's voices? We are delighted to be joined in the studio by Neka Akudolu, KC, a barrister with 20 years' experience. She specialises in complex crimes, murder, drug trafficking and serious sexual offences. And she's someone who knows all about building a case. Hello, Neka.
Hello, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
And of course, our super in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University. Hello, Ros.
Hello, Lucy.
Hello, Neka.
Hello.
Now, we're going to kick off with looking at evidence. And Neka, the way you use evidence when you're prosecuting a case is vital, right? But let me ask this. In our marvellous modern digital age, can there ever be too much evidence?
Obviously, there is, in this digital age, a plethora of evidence that can be presented to a jury. And something that we have now that we possibly didn't have 20, 30 years ago is the emergence of social media. So Snapchat, TikTok, Twitter, things that are posted online can also now be used as evidence that can support and lead to successful convictions.
How do you sort the wheat from the chaff? Are you very quick at sort of going through and making decisions about relevance?
Well, we have to, you know, there has to be a rigorous process of going through all of the evidence to ensure that we are only presenting evidence that's relevant. So it is a really rigorous process of sifting through a lot of the time, large volumes of material. But, you know, we're used to that because that's sort of our day-to-day job.
Ros, let's come to you. Evidence is fascinating for us as historians, isn't it? Particularly when written records are slim. In our case of Jane and Anne Boyd in Northern Ireland, the team had very limited evidence to piece together the story. This is the tragic case where a mother and daughter were accused of murdering the daughter's newborn baby. Here's the bit where Roz and I go to visit a reconstructed house very similar to the one in which the crime took place.
It looked lovely from the outside. On a sunny day, inside it's pretty damp. To be honest, it chills the bones. And this is not a big house for a family of five. We have William Boyd, the dad. Then there's Jane, the mum. There's a grown-up daughter called Mary Jane. There's a son, James. And then there's Anne. She's recently come home from a job, domestic service, in Dundonald, a few miles away. And Anne is pregnant.
Now, Roz, the documents for this case are scarce, to say the least of it, and we don't even have the actual house where the crime took place. Can you tell us about some of the challenges you faced in putting this rural Northern Irish jigsaw together?
Yes, absolutely, Lucy. So what I really wanted to do in this series was to include a case of newborn child murder, as we call infanticide. And I found this case, there was a reference to it in Elaine Farrell's wonderful book on 19th century Ireland and infanticide. Now, unfortunately for the case, all that survives are two newspaper reports, one on the inquest and one on the trial itself. So there wasn't much to go on here at all. However, as historians, we can still build a picture of what's going on by using what I would call contextual evidence, evidence that you collect from around the case. Here we went back to typical local history sources. So, for example, county directories or town directories. These are almost like your 19th century phone book that lists prominent people who lived in the town and the various services. It gives you a picture of the town. And we even found the doctor who accused Jane Boyd of murdering her grandchild in the directory. So that gave us a bit of a picture. From there, we also went to a big volume called Griffith's Valuation. Now, the census records for 19th century Ireland don't survive. So historians typically rely on this volume, Griffith's Valuation, to give them evidence that they would otherwise draw from the census. Now, this man, Richard Griffith, did a land valuation in the mid-19th century. And it just so happened that he visited Holywood and Ballykeel within Holywood just within months of our case. And there we were able to find the house that Jane and Anne Boyd lived in with the rest of the family. And having that context then allowed us to go to the Ulster Folk Museum, which is nearby to Holywood in Coltrane, and talk to the staff there and say, this is the information we've got. And they were able to identify a cottage that would have been very similar to the one that the Boyd family had lived in.
I have to say, going to the cottage gave a real sense of the pressures that existed on a family like that in their living situation. Nika, what do you do, though, if you've been given a case to defend where there isn't as much evidence as you would have liked? Let me put it that way.
That's always the way. When I'm prosecuting this, sometimes never as much evidence as I like. When I'm defending, there's too much evidence. But when you're prosecuting, what you are able to do in certain cases, for example, a sexual assault case where it's one person's word against another, there may be other surrounding circumstances that are able to assist with corroborating, for example, what a witness has said. So perhaps a stepdaughter who's made allegations, historic allegations against her stepfather. He's no longer with her mother now due to infidelity. And he's saying, well, she's just made this up to get revenge. But what the prosecution were able to do, and I was defending in this case, the stepdaughter had actually, at the time, told very close friends of hers when she was 12 years old of her allegations. So the prosecution were able to go back to those friends who she hadn't seen in 20 years, and they were able to give very compelling evidence that she told them at the time. So they were able to rebut any suggestion that this was a recent fabrication. And so there can be cases where, although there's one person's word against another, there are other potential surrounding circumstances that can corroborate what a victim has said.
I wouldn't wish being involved in a case like that upon anyone at any level. But I can also at the same time see a certain pleasure in putting the pieces together, right? It's fascinating.
Absolutely. And in another case that I was prosecuting,
where a maths teacher had assaulted one complainant, and years and years before he'd assaulted in similar circumstances another. And this other complainant years before had actually undergone a trial and not been believed. And so where we had one victim sort of very recently, we were able to then call that previous victim who'd not been believed, and she came and gave evidence which added support for the young girl. And so putting all of that together and then presenting your arguments to the jury at the end to say, you know, this is clearly no coincidence. These individuals don't know each other. And he was found guilty.
Now let's turn to our historic cases now. In the case of Maria Manning, we had precisely the opposite problem of too little evidence. This is the case of the so-called Lady Macbeth of Bermondsey, who colluded with her husband to kill her lover. Her case became so famous that not only were there the police records and the court records, there were literally stacks of newspaper articles relishing and reporting the gory crime.
When a handcuff was first placed upon her wrist, her rage and despair knew no bounds.
She was attired in black satin trimmed with black lace. She wore a white straw bonnet and a deep, rich black lace fall, which entirely shrouded her features.
In her pocket was found a large piece of broken glass, a most dangerous missile, well calculated to have inflicted a deadly injury upon any person who might have been struck with it.
I love the fashion take. Now, Ross, I know that you love nothing better than a great big stack of Victorian newspapers. Why did this case attract so much attention?
Yes, no, it is true. I do love a great big stack of Victorian newspapers. Here it was the unique circumstances of this case. So first of all, you have the nature of the killing. This is a body that's found underneath a kitchen floor. It almost isn't found as well. A husband and wife who occupy the house and are the suspect killers in this strange threesome with the victim. And of course, she's foreign. Second, you've got the chase element because they go on the run. And that's exciting, isn't it? And they're the new newspapers. It's the press of the mid-19th century. There's lots of it. And they want to track this. Also, at the same time, the police are using the press because they know if they can put out descriptions of the suspects, they have a better chance of catching them. And finally, you've got in this period, this drama of crime and punishment. So when people are brought before the magistrate's court for their committal hearing and they're kept in prison for a while and then their trial and then their punishment, and the gaps in between are relatively short. So you're able to keep up a pace in the newspaper reporting to keep people interested. You don't have to miss an issue. And so it's this daily drama or weekly drama that comes out.
How do you go about sifting the truth out of all of this sort of frothy newspaper reporting?
Yeah, in this case, loads of sources. With the newspapers, what we tend to do as historians is to come up with a method for analysing them so that we don't have to read every single one. So you might choose an example of the popular press, the weekly newspapers, such as Lloyd's Weekly News. Let's just focus on that newspaper and see how they report it. However, when you get to the criminal justice records, the police records, the court records, etc., this is where you actually do have to read everything, because you might miss something really significant if you don't. You do have to go to the National Archives. You do have to get that police file, and you have to turn every page so you do not miss that golden nugget. And it's just what history is as a discipline. It's very much like law. These are disciplines where you have to read a lot, and it's capturing all of that evidence, and it's the summarising and the coming out with some kind of outcome argument about what's going on here.
Necker, have you ever been feeling overwhelmed by information? Oh. Almost so much that you can't read it all.
Many times. And I'm afraid there's no such thing as can't read it all, because we have to read everything, because it's you know, it's quite common as criminal barristers particularly to receive papers sort of the night before or the Friday before a trial starts on Monday, and you're assimilating so much and absorbing so much material in a very short space of time. And if you're prosecuting, obviously you have to bring all that material together in a really easily digestible way for the jury to understand. So there is, and it's exactly as Ross has said, that you will get information from various different sources, putting all those strands together to present it in a really
easily understandable and comprehensive way for a jury.
Now, staying with the case of Maria Manning, when this case does come to trial, we get this rather distasteful standoff between Maria and her husband. They're both flinging accusations at the other one and saying the other one did it. Necker, what happens in court when you've got two people blaming each other for the same crime?
Well, that's what we call a cutthroat defence. And really, there's only one party that benefits from multiple defendants cutting each other's throats, and that's the prosecution. Because whilst the defendants are battling it out, throwing mud at each other, the prosecution can really sit back and let it happen. So it's typically very messy. And as in this case, will often lead to both defendants being convicted because the jury will usually think, well, they're both as bad as each other. They've been able to throw sufficient mud at each other to really discredit each other. So it tends to end badly.
Now, Roz, it's obviously hard to get to the truth in one of these cutthroat cases where one person is blaming another. Which brings us on to a wider question of truth. As we understand it as historians, how hard is it to get to the truth, and how important is it, and what is the truth anyway?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a question that really goes to the heart of my discipline as a historian as well. There is or was a kind of school in history called the positivists. This is going back a bit. Now, this group in history believed that if you could assemble all the evidence together and go through it in a very objective way, then somehow you would arrive at the truth. Okay, they firmly believe this. It's the idea of the dispassionate observer. However, I think most, if not all historians today are much more skeptical about that. And we realize that all sources come with a perspective. And our job as historians is to assemble all those different perspectives. And the truth usually lies somewhere in the middle of that. At the same time, we're also very good at understanding that we as historians come with a perspective as well, you know, a bias that comes from our own present day circumstance. So we try to work against that or acknowledge that when we're doing history.
Mm. What you're really saying is that history is about opening up conversations that throw light on us today in the present. Now, equally fascinating when it comes to the truth is the case of Frances Kidder, accused of drowning her 11-year-old stepdaughter in a ditch. Now, if we are to believe Frances, she's hard done by, trapped in an abusive relationship, unaware that her husband had two children from a previous relationship.
On the 7th of November, my husband knocked me about very much. He did so yesterday, also on Saturday night and the night before. On Tuesday, he struck me on the head and knocked me against a shelf, and then he kicked me on the legs.
But our meticulous investigations unearthed a slightly different side to Frances. By going through the newspaper records with a fine-tooth comb, Roz discovered that Frances Kidder had made numerous previous court appearances. She was fined for assaulting an elderly neighbour, fined again for breaking another neighbour's window, and also for pouring a bucket of water down his chimney. She might not be the victim that at first we thought that she was. Necker, does this ever happen to you in court, that the initial impression that a person makes, a bit of digging and it turns out to be very different?
Well, yes. And it typically happens when I'm defending, when everything has probably gone as well as I thought it was going to go. And then a defendant gets in the witness box and reveals a whole new different side to himself. And that's when things tend to start to unravel. So that's happened, not very often, but it's certainly happened to me.
How do you mitigate against that? Do you ask them really seriously right up front if they've told you everything?
Well, if a defendant has pleaded not guilty, then I proceed on the basis that they haven't done what they're accused of doing. But sometimes, there is a certain amount of pressure giving evidence. And in terms of mitigating the behaviour of a defendant during the course of their evidence, you say to the jury, well, you probably found it difficult just standing up and taking an oath in front of a room full of people. Imagine having to give very difficult evidence in front of a room full of strangers. So, you can't really predict how someone is going to react.
Even within our cases, there can be multiple versions of the truth. In the case of Jane and Anne Boyd, the truth is changed many times. Jane starts by saying,
"There was a child. It was buried in the garden. The child was dead. It was born dead. Sure, it was born dead."
But we know this isn't true because later she changes her story and she says that the baby was born alive. And this fact is confirmed by her own son. Neka, what do you do if somebody changes their story like this?
The main thing you want to be able to say to a jury when you're addressing them is that your client has remained consistent throughout. They've been interviewed by the police and they've said exactly the same thing when they've given evidence. If you are in the position where your client has changed their story, it's not really a great look. It will sometimes lead a jury to think that they just can't be believed.
Neka, has this happened to you, somebody changing their story partway through?
I mean, it does happen. And it will happen typically, you know, when an individual is pulled in for an interview and it's a rape case, you know, the allegation is made against an individual from someone they know. And the suspect at the time says, "We didn't even have sex." But then, of course, forensic evidence is produced. That forensic evidence shows that there is the defendant's DNA, semen, inside the complainant. And then typically, of course, there will have to be a concession that sex has taken place, but that it was consensual. That is very common.
You're looking weary, like you've experienced this many times.
It happens many times. And then you are, of course, as a defence advocate, you are stuck with what that person had said during the course of their interview. But you have to be able to explain, this person has been arrested for a very serious offence. The first thing they did was to panic. And they panicked not because they had done it, but just because, you know, they were fearful of the enormity of the situation that they were in. And so in that moment, they made the decision to not tell the truth. But they are telling the truth now.
I can tell that you've got a superpower, which is making jurors feel like they trust you, that you're giving them the real insight into human nature.
And they should trust me.
I was beginning to feel he didn't do it. No.
He didn't.
Yeah. Fascinating. It's a real skill. Now, the issue of how we get to the truth brings us on to the last of the cases we'll discuss today. Marie Christensen, accused of killing a six-year-old girl, Casey, in a mission school for Indigenous or First Nations children in Australia. Now, I find this case fascinating because it's the testimony of the Indigenous women whose voices might not otherwise get recorded at all that help us to get to the truth of what happened. Here's the voice of Polly Roberts, who was an eyewitness to Marie Christensen cruelly treating little Casey.
"I was standing at the well and I saw her kick and beat the child with a stick. I was standing about 400 yards from where this all happened."
Roz, how unusual is this to have the voices of marginalised women recorded through the legal process?
Actually, it's not that unusual at all. And it's often legal documents, court records, police records that are the best place to look for the voices of marginalised women. There's a wonderful book by a French historian, Arlette Farge, called The Allure of the Archives. I use it with students. And it's all about her experiences in the Ministry of Justice archives in France. And she talks about how she opens ledgers of police records. And in them, she finds out all about the lives of these marginalised women on the streets of Paris in the 19th century. It's an absolutely fascinating book. Coming on to the Christensen case. Now, this case is particularly special to me, because it was the particular circumstances of this mission in 19th century Australia that gave rise to Indigenous voices in the records that we might not otherwise have. So, of course, it was the doctor who refused to sign the death certificate, which triggered an inquest. The man who was put in charge of that inquest, the local Justice of the Peace, Bill North, and his relationship with the Indigenous community, which meant that he felt comfortable or able to interview the Indigenous women as witnesses. And then, of course, it's about the economic value of that mission, the value of the labour of the people who lived on that mission that meant it was not as oppressive or highly regulated as other missions. And so the women felt that they could speak out in the first place. I think it's really important that we listen hard to these voices, that we listen to what these women are trying to tell us, not just about the crime they witnessed, but about the society in which they lived. I think this is a really important point. We have these women who are ready to speak out, who are ready to challenge, but at the same time, they're also curtailed in what they can say. They are stopped from intervening, for example, in the treatment of Casey. And this really reveals a complicated situation for us, how women in these conditions, in basically an oppressive and racist environment, are able to exert their agency.
Nika, if you think about the legal system today, do you think that there are some women who have more agency than others to make their voices heard?
I think definitely. There are cases that I've been involved in where women specifically haven't felt they're able to come forward because of potential repercussions. A case, for example, again, where I prosecuted, it was a very high profile case where the defendant was charged with attempted murder on a police officer. And there was an eyewitness who had received considerable pressure from the local community, but she felt that she'd needed to. So despite that pressure and the fear that she faced, she still came forward and gave evidence.
Wow. Amazing. Nika, your work sounds incredibly challenging. How do you deal with that? How do you personally deal with all of this dark stuff that you have to cope with in your job?
Well, in all honesty, you know, Married at First Sight, TOWIE, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Escapist television.
It keeps me being able to do my job.
Fabulous. So. Now, hopefully we've taken you on a journey, peering through the doorway, opening the drawer, unfolding the papers, to hear a little bit more about what we actually do here at Lady Killers to bring you, our loyal listeners, the truth about our alleged murderesses. Roz has given us a glimpse of how we piece together the fragments from the archives, the newspapers, the maps, the crime scenes to tell the stories of our lady killers. And we've seen how evidence could be weaponized in the courtroom, used as a tool against these women who were living in a world that was made for men. We have to listen very carefully to hear these women's voices, but we can do it if we try. And it's very comforting to know that in the 21st century, we got wonderful people like Nneka Akudolu to stand up for women today. Well, a huge thank you to King's Counsel Nneka Akudolu and to Professor Rosalind Crone. Join me next time on Lady Killers when a middle-aged mother is accused of plotting to murder a US president. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Emily Hughes and the series producer is Julia Habel. Sound design is by Chris McLean. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. What can the Lady Killers cases teach us about the authenticity of women's stories? The Open University takes a look at how we can reclaim female voices from history. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.
I just would take my glasses off and the executioner would start.
Can you imagine your job being to help legally kill people?
It's a hell of a thing to watch a man die.
I'm Livy Haydock, and I once heard the wildest story about how the USA ran short of death row drugs and had to find them in the UK.
Drugs used in some of the executions are supplied by a British businessman.
That got me digging into what death row looks like now.
Well, they all died. Nobody complained.
And what might happen to it in the future. This is Killing Death Row from BBC Radio 4 with me, Livy Haydock. Listen on BBC Sounds.
On Big Lives, we take a single cultural icon.
People like Jane Fonda, George Michael, Little Richard.
And we pull apart the story behind the image.
And we do this by digging through the BBC's vast archives.
Discovering forgotten interviews that changed exactly how we see these giants of our culture.
We're here for the messy, the brilliant, the human version of our heroes.
I'm Emmanuel Joachi.
I'm Kai Wright.
And this is Big Lives.
Listen to Big Lives wherever you get your podcasts.